It's a combination of brain power, ostensible brain power, plus need to cross the cultural gap. Let's see, so to the one person from Santa Barbara, let's start by that. In 1969 and 1970, while visiting, I'm grateful to the city of Santa Barbara, because in 1969 and 1970, if you can remember back then, which you can't, a complex teenager, Santa Barbara made a huge difference in my straightening out my subsequent adolescence. So I'm, it's on. So I'm eternally grateful to Santa Barbara in those days. I was an undergraduate in computer science and mathematics at the University of Southern Mississippi some years later, in 1972 and 1973, and I had to make the choice between what was good in computer science at the time, what was lordly, was compiler design, formal language theory, and I wasn't any good at that. I was actually good at hardware design. I was also learning molecular biology. It was impossible not to grow up during the 1960s and read in the newspaper every day that the ribosome had been discovered or that messenger RNA had been discovered. It was in the air, it was in the water. As an undergraduate, I was also fooling around with protein folding on the IBM 360 Model 40, available to me at the time, using so-called heuristic programming techniques, which were then, it means something different from what it means now, but the ideas, the Marvin Minsky idea at the time was that the computer could discover its own rules. Where human intelligence couldn't go, the computer could. Of course, that was crap. It was hype from the MIT artificial intelligence people anyway, but like a little kid, you know, in a provincial university, I thought it was real and attempted to act on it. In any case, I wanted to do molecular biology. I then had a computer background and desire and knowledge to do biology. I actually wrote Walter Fitch at the University of Wisconsin, constructor of phylogenetic trees, wanting to work in your lab, Walter. This would have been in 1972. And you said yes, and I wound up going, I wrote Wisconsin, Harvard, and Stanford, and wound up going to graduate school at Harvard. But this is a... Years go by, okay. I really felt that I needed to learn molecular biology as a discipline. Harvard was where it was at the time, or it was one of the places where it was at. And eventually I wound up in Mark Potashny's lab, where I became a hardcore molecular biologist, always with a kind of confusion about between finding things out scientifically and creating things so that you could find things out scientifically. A confusion, if you will, between kind of science with an engineering streak. And the culmination of that, I was both a graduate and a student and a postdoc with Mark, who will be lecturing here tomorrow. So I was in his lab for almost 10 years. The culmination of those experiments was I put prokaryotic DNA binding proteins into eukaryotes, got them to regulate gene expression, began mixing and matching transcription activation pieces of different proteins with different functions, which to my people, the molecular biologists, that kind of opened the way for a kind of moronic protein engineering, where you bolt parts of proteins onto one another and get chimeric proteins with chimeric functions without paying that much attention to the kind of actual structure of the proteins that you're bolting together. It works more often than not. So I'm halfway responsible for that, getting us farther down that slippery slope of understanding biologists understanding even less about the physical chemistry of the molecules they're working with. Eventually these I helped parlay these things into broad but shallow methods to give insight into gene function, some of which I will discuss today. Things that tell whether proteins touch each other, ways to manipulate protein-protein interactions, etc. This brings us to about the middle 1990s. I'm a professor at Harvard. I'm now at the medical school. My colleagues down the hall are exulting when they have a protein involved in arthritis, and they can use my methods to find another protein which interacts with the first protein involved in arthritis, which thus might be involved in arthritis. This is perfectly well and good. This is biomedical research writ large. This is what the people pay, you know, this is what the taxpayer pays for. But it is not why I became a biologist. I did not become a biologist to exult in the next protein that might also be involved in arthritis. And it got me soul searching and trying to figure out where biology needed to go. And it seemed pretty clear. Biology needed to be more predictive. I'll get back to that in a second. It needed to be more predictive, so to be more predictive, we needed more better kinds of biological information. We needed analytical frameworks in which we could put that information and they would make meaningful predictions about, strong predictions about future state based on present state. Or to flip that around, a measure of our ignorance, a good operational measure of our ignorance as biologists is our inability, armed with knowledge of the present state, to predict future behavior. The information to make the future organism is there in the genome. It is there in digital form, basically ones and zeros. It is read out, and we know kind of the process, but we can't look at a genome and figure out what the organism will look like. We can't, armed with knowledge, we can't even get experimentally knowledge of, say, a couple hundred regulatory proteins or phosphorylation states and association states. Amounts and so on, we can't predict whether a given tumor will respond to an anti-cancer drug or not. Anywhere you look, biology is insufficiently predictive. And the reasons, I submit again, are twofold. I'll get back to that. Lack of analytical framework, lack of good experimental methods. Therefore, we have to do both. I started both banging on the United States scientific establishment to move more in that direction, and corresponding with Sidney Brenner, who's one of the founders of molecular biology. Sidney had very similar ideas, and when our ideas were dissimilar, his were larger than mine. The key one in which they were dissimilar is Sidney said, Roger, you're not going to be able to do this at Harvard. It's going to need physics refugees, it's going to need mathematicians, it's going to need computer scientists, it's going to need it's going to need people of very high caliber, it's going to need no competing agendas. It's not going to work at Harvard Medical School, or very easily inside any other university department. Step outside for a while. And so we started the Molecular Sciences Institute. I left Harvard in 1998. We built out lab space in Berkeley, and we have a research institute which is dedicated toward making more better kinds of experimental biological knowledge and throwing that knowledge into mechanism-based, no bullshit, computational representations of the information with the hope to divine greater understanding into system behavior. So I'm going to talk about that work. Okay, so that's kind of the bio insofar as it's relevant. Now, so we started on topic one. So I planned on 90 minutes with a break in the middle. So a lot of this is going to be a survey of methods. I'm going to start there. And I apologize for that, but you must remember that the experimental methods are the soil from which all this springs, and it's important to enumerate them. Many of them you haven't heard about. Then I'm going to outline a possibly useful qualitative approach and broach the topic that most biological knowledge now is qualitative. What can we do with it? Then I'm going to talk about quantitative models. I'm going to describe an ongoing and so far successful experimental computational approach. Go into something that's probably obvious to some of the people here, which is what construction of real predictive models would get you. And then I'm going to be very speculative at the end. I'm scared because this is an audience that actually knows this kind of stuff. How do you get traction on the problem of system behavior? And so I'm going to propose something. Okay? So, I mean, you can't get behind the complete inventory of biological parts, but that's happened anyway, because my tribe, the molecular biologists, have been beavering away. And so how do they work together to create system outcomes? So this was part of the thinking in 1995. That's a factory. This is the shop floor of the Institute of Genome Research. This is a posed photograph. The automaton-like machine tenders there, it's staged. The machines, you may know, in the 1980s there was promulgated a thing called a microprocessor. So actually these machines are actually controlled by control circuitry. They run by themselves. There's no need for a human being to stand in front of them and look gloomy. But the point is that you know, for those who had eyes to see, the parts list was incoming, and there's various other kinds of systematically produced data. I'm going to say genomic is synonymous with that which you can produce in a factory, that were coming and were going to tell us a lot about biology, but also illustrate how little it was we already knew. And that this was basically going to eventually change and end the cottage enterprise aspect of biological data collection as we knew it. The analogy, obviously, is with an earlier sea change in human culture. This is from the vicinity of Manchester, circa 1840 or so. And the only thing I'd call your attention to is actually, you know, if you look at these people, that people were a lot happier working in factories in, I mean, even the, you know, the 13-year-old here, you know, with the box on his head, you know, he's, no, this is actually the real scientific experience. So this is a, I can't resist, this is a guy named Lars, I know him. This is the shop floor of the single nucleotide polymorphism room in the Ron Davis lab, and there's Lars, you know, kind of deer in the headlights of the oncoming, you know, technological revolution. The scientific experience is still, you know, clearly, this is a graduate student. This is an alienating and lonely time. You know, nothing really fundamentally has changed, is what I'm saying. Okay, now, introduction to networks, and I'm going to get back to this. You're transported back into time in the 1950s, and you ask what's important about how cells work. What's the important network, and the you know, the gurus of the time, the graying, you know, patriarchs, all say metabolism. They say making stuff and breaking stuff down is what's the important thing about being a cell. And I'll get back to this toward the end of the talk. But so what you got to understand are these metabolic networks, these networks. Okay, so what you're seeing here is a schematic representation of the production line in yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that makes the amino acid threonine. And what you have are these protein molecules, these enzymes, these kind of big workstations, and what they're doing is they're schlepping the small molecule from one to the other. So it's a, you know, it's a 19th century or early 20th century production line. And there's feedback mechanisms in these networks and so on, but essentially, they're developed in parallel to this understanding in the 1950s, the understanding of the molecular biologist, which cares not a bit about where stuff comes from, how stuff is made. It's like, and I'll get back to this, the industrial economy today in California. Stuff is made somewhere else, in the Pacific Rim, somewhere. It doesn't really matter where it's made, or it doesn't matter much how it's made. What's important is trying to figure out what to do. All the value adding, all the cool stuff, is not in the manufacture, but in the decision making. Now, whether or not this is, you know, true and fair, this is the model of our time, but this was also what kind of launched molecular biology. What is the decision making? How do cells do one thing and not the other thing? How do organisms do one thing and not the other thing? Okay, now what you're looking at is part of a wiring diagram done by a maniacal person named Cohn at the National Cancer Institute in 1999. Now, this is an attempt to schematize the circuitry involved in mammalian cells in the G1 to S transition. Okay, so in our lingo, what that means is the cells deciding whether to divide or not. And so when it ought to divide, when it has food, when it has growth factors and so on, it makes a decision to enter S phase and replicate its DNA, and in fact complete the whole rest of what's called the cell cycle, pull apart into two cells. So this is the decision point for making a whole new cell. And so what you have is a bunch of proteins denoted by ellipses, and then they have various interactions with one another which are denoted by arrows. There's different kinds of arrowheads, and I spared you this, but there's different colors of lines and different colors of arrows. And these, the totality of this protein circuitry, more or less freely diffusing within the cytoplasm and within the nucleus of mammalian cells, is what makes the decision whether the cell divides or not. So the problem of, you know, understanding a network is not the 50s problem of metabolism, nor does, broadly speaking, current molecular cell and developmental biology care a bit about metabolic networks. Not a bit. You know, it's of interest to chemical engineers, fine. But in terms of relevance to biology, you know, biology, for good or ill, since post-World War II, has concerned itself predominantly, you know, and current molecular cell biology and developmental biology concerns itself with, how are these decisions made? And I'm showing you a piece of a circuit where the decisions are made by proteins bumping into one another, putting phosphate groups on one another, forming dimers, moving to the nucleus, going through these stylized activities, and somehow out of this, these components, with this quote architecture, end quote, we get the system behavior, we get the decision to divide or not. So that's the problem. Okay. Did I say this already? Yeah. Yep.
This as the goal, or what, here is an example.
This specific problem is not one that I am dedicated to understanding right now. I'm telling you that this is first, that this chart does not do violence to the facts on the ground in 1999. It's fair, and it's also pretty complete. There haven't been since 99, and I wouldn't expect there to be large numbers of hitherto undiscovered components or connections among the components coming up here. But if we wish to understand how cells decide to divide, at some level, we're going to have to understand this. Understanding of this is a problem that I don't anticipate this decade or maybe next decade.
Bank
on genomic and contemporary molecular and cellular biology to extend charts like this. But then at the end of the day, and we're going to try to work on rate constants and so on, but at the end of the day, this is not a model. And so I guess the main point, I'm going to try to make a couple of main points, but one is, I'll just move right to the end of the talk. Any higher level of abstraction that gives us any understanding at a level above this, we welcome now. Okay, so and so theory with all the, that has a negative connotation in biological, among many biologists, as you know, and it has a bad history. So in molecular and cellular biology and developmental biology, in fact, broadly speaking, theory with that of some kinds has been irrelevant to the enterprise. It's time to get it back. So that's the bottom line. Okay, so now I'm going to survey methods. Now, again, I'm making this distinction. I'm going to say that genomic, without going into proteomic, you know, RNAomic and so on, genomic is anything you can do by turning a crank that and gives you information about all the entities in a class. So anything you can do in a factory is genomic. Biological knowledge nowadays comes from both factories and from ad hoc experimentation. Remember that by far the bulk of what we know to be true in biology still comes from directed ad hoc experimentation. So, golly, the methods are inadequate, and the ideological frameworks for extracting understanding are inadequate. So, this is why I'm here. This is why, since 1998, I've been involved in this extremely difficult culture-crossing exercise at the Molecular Sciences Institute. Okay, genetic information continued. There's information coming from DNA sequence. I'm just not going to cover that here. I'm going to talk a little bit about messenger RNA information because it's so much on the minds of people, perhaps including you guys. I'm not going to really mention protein structure information. I am going to mention protein interaction information and some other kinds of incoming information. To make the obvious thing, it's more than mRNA, and second, obviously, each data type has its own characteristics, its own data handling, i.e. informatic needs, and eventually its own ways in which thoughtful mathematicians and people who know about things can add value to it. So it's not one problem, it's many problems, and each of these is quite distinct, and each of them will benefit. All right, well, so by DNA sequence information, I mean genome sequence, sequence of cDNAs, implied primary sequence of proteins, information about nucleotide polymorphisms. One advantage of this data type is it's generally true, it's subjected to rigorous quality control, it's unambiguous, it easily lends itself to mathematical and statistical methods. And the sequence of a protein is one of the best clues to its biological function writ small. I'm going to get to the problem of function in the second part of the talk, but in other words, the sequence of a protein can say it's a protein kinase, a protein that puts a phosphate group on another protein. The sequence of the protein will not, by itself, say that the protein is involved in forming an eye or learning and memory, but it will reveal the biochemical function. It also, the sequence is no immediate guide to its behavior as a member of a network. Just to continue the survey, and either slow me down or speed me up if you get bored. mRNA expression data, I'm going to concentrate on so-called chip data. Now, what you do here is you take a sample, which could be somebody's tumor, it could be blood cells, it could be anything, quote, sample, end quote. Take out all the proteins, isolate the mRNA, make complementary DNA, cDNA from it. Amplify it by PCR or don't. Label it, for example, with a fluorescent dye. Hybridize it together with a differently colored reference DNA to the array, and score the amounts of different colored fluorescence hybridized to different patches of the array. Now, there are other things you can do with arrays of nucleic acids in addition to monitoring the abundance of different messenger RNAs in a sample, but I'm going to concentrate on that. For a number of reasons, some of which are intrinsic to the sociology at the time, there are other methods to monitor mRNA expression, lots of other methods, and I'm not going to cover those either because they're not relevant. Perhaps you've seen pictures. So, you know, generically, chips, so these are in housings. The affymetrix is made by photolithographic synthesis of oligonucleotides on derivatized glass. The InSight Centenni chips and other chips are just made by spotting double-stranded nucleic acids onto derivatized glass. These are extremely expensive, about $1,000 a pop. When you can get them, quality control is an epidemic. Quality control problems persist. What else? Because it's so hemmed in by intellectual property concerns, basically researchers have had time as a community to figure out how to use these well and add value to the data. The people who have access to these technologies are largely researchers within the 10 largest pharmaceutical companies, which comprise the oligopoly that's able to make drugs effectively, and each group in such an institution reinvents the wheel. So we don't know as much about how to deal with this kind of data as we might like. But Brown and Botstein and Michael Eisen introduced to this data an iconic, a common representation. Red relative to the standard is increased gene expression, green is down. Now, this is the kind of level we're at intellectually here. Genes with similar expression patterns may have similar function. For example, here's a bunch of chip data. This is messenger RNA from yeast. And yeast, when the going gets tough and it's diploid, can form spores. And so the numbers appear to denote time and hours after they started this process. And this yeast gene of hitherto unknown function, YGR266C, comes from the sequence. Look at XO1. It has an expression pattern quite similar to XO1. So this allows the perspicacious investigator to say, gee, maybe YGR266C is also needed for sporulation. Now, so this is the kind of stuff one does with gene expression data. One, you know, I guess one of the major things is to make inferences about the function of genes of hitherto unknown function based on expression pattern. Now, this is one of the things that a lot of people think they do with gene expression data. You might think, and it was a great idea, probably first had by Stuart Kaufman, probably in 1968 or 1969, that living cells move from one state to the other by expressing proteins that were themselves regulatory proteins, that in turn controlled the expression of other regulatory proteins, which in turn controlled the expression of other regulatory proteins, so that there were different constellations of regulatory proteins cross-regulating one another that govern the transition of the living cell from state to state. Marvelous idea, and in fact, just, you know, kind of simple considerations in the late 1960s suggested that there was a marvelous array of different states that could be attained in a cell by postulating very simple regulatory networks of this type, that the behaviors of these regulatory networks, composed of simple components, were themselves surprisingly complex. This was early days. And in fact, the entire vocabulary of state space, trajectories, attractors, etc., got unleashed on the analysis of these imaginary regulatory networks. So, by the way, I'm carrying with PDF files, not hard copy files. Drew Endy and I had an article in Nature which earlier this year in January, which made this point very strongly. By and large, these genetic regulatory networks of this type do not exist. This is not how living cells, by and large, regulate their transition from state to state. By and large, people who examine gene expression data, thinking that the expression of the genes is controlled in these different states in the cell is controlled by these patterns of cross-regulating gene regulatory proteins, with the object of reverse engineering the genetically, you know, the genetic regulatory network, by and large, this is probably not a fruitful exercise. And, you know, I don't need to get into it much here, but, you know, if you look at how living cells do regulate transcription from transitions from state to state, they're always going back to the genome and kind of rebooting is a better analogy to how they do it. You invoke a new subprogram with a single or a very small number of gene regulatory proteins, and then that kind of carries itself out. I can do that in the discussion, and I wasn't planning to. But I mean, that I guess part of something when somebody like me comes to a gathering like this, what I do want to make the point is that there's more things out there than this gene regulatory data, and that especially you need to beware of applying really recondite and high level analytical skills to something if you think it's going to be relevant to biology. You know, if, as a theoretical problem, you know, who's to knock it? But if part of your motivation is to say that I really think this is going to feed back into a real biological understanding, then it's the duty of people like me to kind of give a little bit of perspective on that.
Could you not just say, what you mean by the alternative? It's not a network in which the factors play games against each other, but it is one.
Yeah, okay, well, I think very frequently what you see is, Well, let's see. So let's do that in two ways. What you don't see, you know, like you have the sequence of the yeast genome, and you don't see transcription regulators which bind to sites upstream of other transcription regulators and control the synthesis in the way that would be needed to effect the transition from Kaufman state to Kaufman state to Kaufman state. So that's a negative statement. This is what you don't have a lot of examples of in biology whenever you look, including in some systems which are so well described that you would actually see it if they existed. By contrast, you have things like you seem to have these, and I'm sorry if this sounds a little waffly, developmental subprograms. So I guess the here's a canonical case. Hal Weintraub, middle 1980s, he says, why is a fibroblast different from a myoblast, a muscle precursor cell? So he says, maybe there's a gene which turns fibroblasts into myoblasts. So he finds a gene that encodes a protein called MyoD, which, when expressed in fibroblasts, turns the fibroblasts into myoblasts. There's three other proteins, or four now, homologous to MyoD, essentially vertebrate genomes probably quadruplicated from an ancestral thing. So when worms and flies have one of things, we tend to have four or five or maybe three. So what this guy does is, MyoD does, is in complex with another protein, it binds to DNA upstream of genes like myosin and actin and turns on their transcription. So it seems to be a relatively, it's a single step. And so that is sufficient to effect this transition of the cell from one state to the next. Now, the myoblasts go on in normal development and they fuse together to make a muscle fiber. So there's many nuclei inside this fused thing. The fused thing is called a syncytium in the vernacular. So program that causes that is not, to my knowledge, known, but we imagine that that's perhaps due to some environmental trigger, transcription of another whole set of genes to take you to the next step. Rather than this cross-regulation, it's like go from this point to this point and then stop, get new signal, from this point to this point and then stop. Does that,
But on the other hand, the last week was hearing about checkpoints and things like that, which is sort of more exciting.
Well, I was going to get to checkpoints toward the end, but the question of how a living system keeps its behavior on track, part of it is by going this far and no further until some new signal comes in, which can be from the external environment or from elsewhere within the cell. This is a big, important problem. Maybe I can print out the Nature. I'm going to print out the Cell and Nature view. Sorry? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh no, I'm not saying anything about time zero. This is a very look. This is a very good. I want to have this discussion this afternoon. I think that our knowledge of the network doesn't easily tell us how things can be reversed, but we can, you know, for example, de-differentiate cells and whatnot. So at some level. At some level, things can be reversed, and I don't think the current understanding of vocabulary among biologists gives good traction on that. So I think that that's the kind of metaphor, if you will, from you guys that we might be able, this is why I'm here. Okay, well, help. Okay, so you can do, you have methods, and I'm not going to go into great detail on most of them, to get information about the amounts of proteins in a sample and protein complexes and their interactions. In fact, it's now 11. So it's 10 till. So I'm going to do methods for 10 more minutes, and then I actually think it might be more fruitful here if people are getting stupefied by the methods, that we might go to the speculative mode. I mean, I'm easy either way, but maybe we can make a real-time decision on that during the break. Okay, methods. Inside cells, work is done by proteins. All the work proteins do. Now, the work that proteins do is not magical. They do it by touching other things. The other things they touch are proteins and or other molecules that are not proteins. But, you know, some fraction of the work, half of it, something like that, is done by proteins touching other proteins. Particularly, it's kind of lordly decision-making work, the shall I divide or not, the kind of information economy work. So during the 1990s, and the rest of the information economy work is done by proteins touching DNA. So if you have those two classes of molecules, you're getting all the intellectual value added in the cell. During the 1990s, methods that provide insight into these things took off. As a result, we have, you know, in a few cases, near, yep.
About protein touching protein.
Yep.
Is there any sort of general understanding of how selective things are?
Well, yeah, sure. Let's see. So the advent of two hybrid methods led to kind of rough censuses of how many partners a given protein had touched with an affinity tighter than a certain threshold. That threshold for our canonical system is about 5 × 10⁻⁵ molar equilibrium dissociation constant. Never mind those units for a minute. That's tight enough to include many kinds of important enzyme-substrate interactions, many kinds of important protein-protein interactions. It's not tight enough to include others. I'll get back to that in 1 second. As a guess, the median number of interacting partners for a protein in yeast is maybe 6 at that affinity level, but there's a strong, there's a great variance to that distribution. Now, a word about that strength of interaction, 5 × 10⁻⁵ molar. Among the protein-protein interactions of vital importance in biology are, for example, interactions between transcription regulatory proteins bound upstream of a gene close to one another, which are touching one another. Potashny, who will be here, he probably will not mention it, but for example, the interaction between lambda repressor and RNA polymerase in E. coli probably has an equilibrium dissociation constant on the order of 10⁻²nd molar. It's incredibly weak, but because the two things are next to one another on the DNA, that interaction is important. There's all sorts of the important protein-protein interaction span. There's a range in number of partners that a protein has, a goodly range, and there's an extraordinary range of affinities in which those interactions are meaningful. In general,
you can think of that. Case is a three-body interaction. And what you're describing is you may mean to define all the two-body interactions at a threshold,
right,
which is qualitatively about right for two-body interactions.
Right.
Are all the exceptions three-body interactions?
There's a good number of two-body interactions in that phrasing, which are, for example, enzyme-substrate interactions where the equilibrium affinity of the substrate for the enzyme isn't high enough. There are all these games that are played inside a cell to make the interactions three-body or to increase, to play games with the local concentrations of the two-body interactions. And that understanding is, it's going to be needed. We're confronting it directly in our simulations, and I think kind of the understanding of that, that's a real good and perhaps relatively simple place for theoretical people to make some progress. Just a picture of, you know, the technology. This is work by Jano Gyuris, a Hungarian postdoc. This so-called two-hybrid method, which, so at the core is this prokaryotic regulatory protein I cloned as a graduate student, Alexei. And so what you have is a bunch of events taking place in the nucleus of the budding E. Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And what you've done is you've suborned this organism. You're using it as a test tube. You care nothing about the biology of this organism. What you are doing is exploiting understanding of eukaryotic transcription activation. You know, in my case, building on experiments I did in the middle 1980s. This red thing here, that says acid, that's an activation domain. And when that thing is close enough to the start point of transcription of a eukaryotic gene, a gene in yeast, that gene will be transcribed. Now, parenthetically, what the acidic transcription activation domain does is it attracts the attention of RNA polymerase and associated proteins and makes it transcribe gene expression here. That mechanism is still not well understood, but we're just exploiting it. So in this cartoon picture, what you have is a protein nailed to the so-called bait, nailed to the DNA via interaction with the Alexei DNA binding site. So what we've done is we've gutted the regulatory region of this gene and replaced it with binding sites for this bacterial repressor protein. Then we've nailed to those binding sites a derivative protein that has Alexei as a DNA binding bit, fused to protein kinase, in this case. Let's say it's a protein kinase. And we have a million yeast like this, and to each of those million yeast, we've introduced a different member of a cDNA library. The library encodes a protein encoded by cDNA, and at the amino terminus of the protein, there's this junk, a nuclear localization sequence, an acidic transcription activation domain, and an epitope tag. So all members of the library have this common amino terminus, those three blobs on their amino terminus. Then if the protein encoded by the cDNA, the fused moiety, interacts with the bait protein, then voila, the activation domain is within striking distance of this gene. The gene is transcribed. If the gene product is, for example, beta-galactosidase that turns a colorless dye blue, indigo, or a gene that enables the yeast to synthesize its own leucine, and the gene is otherwise unable to synthesize leucine, then we can detect the transcription of the gene by the protein product, by the effect, the phenotype of the protein product. Okay, this is a cartoon illustration of that. So this is an example of kind of, you know, now 10-year-old workhorse intracellular biological technology. It's sophisticated, and it's nothing much to look at. But that's, you know, that's to go back. We can scale this up so we can look at interactions among lots and lots and lots of different proteins. The way we, yeah.
The previous slide where you did nothing but look at, that darker block is one of your arrows on that gene network diagram that says that this protein interacts with that protein?
Yes.
And the different colored arrows
you didn't see
is more detailed study of this dark block.
Yeah. So exactly the different colored arrows that you didn't see were attempts to represent the small number of ways that proteins can interact with one another functionally.
So
correct. Yeah. Perchance. Yeah. Exactly. So this is the kind of, and you know, even if it doesn't sound like much in the aggregate, you know, the amount of understanding that's been achieved by this is you know, stupefying. to scale this up, these are vertical stripes of yeast, and what I didn't tell you, I've been glossing over it. Normally in the yeast, you work with the gamete, the haploid. Yeast come in two sexes, A and alpha. And when A and alphas meet, they arrest in quivering anticipation, and then they grow toward one another, and they fuse to form a diploid. In fact, since we have a Copenhagen representation, I recall to your mind that the Copenhagen is, of course, the site of Carlsberg, the people who worked out early industrial yeast genetics. And as you may know, the terms nuclear fission and fusion come from Bohr talking with a guy from Carlsberg. You know, what am I going to call this? You know, what would we call it? It's a fact. So the yeast fuse, the nuclei fuse, and so the two cytoplasms and nucleoplasms are fused. And if the two yeast have two proteins that potentially could interact with one another, and they are rigged so as to look like that, then in the patch where they've mated, you may or may not get a signal like that. All right. So can we do one more method, or are we? Okay. So. Just to say, big surprise. So one of the reporter genes can be a fluorescent protein, and there's a surprisingly decent relationship which has emerged over the past 2 years in work by Pierre Collat, a former postdoc now in Lyon, France, between affinity and the amount of fluorescence. So this is kind of surprisingly well behaved. Now I'm going to cover one abstract topic, and then we're going to break. So along 1992, we realized from direct experimental observation, we could have anticipated it, so that there was information in this. Let's go back. Look, so let's say that this was a protein kinase, a protein that puts a phosphate on another group, on another protein. Now, a very typical experiment might be to find a partner protein for this protein kinase, and then your inference about the function of the partner might be that it was a substrate for the protein kinase. So, you know, that's a testable hypothesis about what this interacting partner might do, and that launches your graduate student, right? So the inference then depend about the function of protein 2 depends on some knowledge about the function of protein 1, that it's a protein kinase. But look, let's say you have three proteins, protein A, B, and C. A interacts with B and C, B interacts with A and C, C interacts with A and B. You can say, maybe these three proteins form a three-protein complex. That is an inference about the function of A, B, and C, which does not depend on any knowledge of the biochemical function of any of those three proteins. It's kind of platonic. It floats without knowledge, does not need reference to current biological knowledge. So we ran into this in 1992 or so, and the Homeboy Mathematician Project was born, which was an attempt to learn how to fork through interaction data of this type to find meaningful protein complexes which might give, which might be of functional significance. If you have interactions in a database, like this would be a 5-protein complex, this pattern of interactions might signal that this is a 6-protein complex. These are supposed to be dotted lines. Here you have the pattern of interactions that actually do obtain. If this is a protein kinase, these are positive and negative regulatory proteins, and these somewhat weaker interactions are its substrates. So can one learn to spot patterns of this type and seas of data of this type? And Larry Locke, who's now de facto head of the math group at the Institute, this is one of the first things he did. He kind of worked on this from 92 to 95 and basically solved that problem. So that was a simple kind of tree search kind of thing. Time for a break. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's right qualitatively. I think the problem is in the qualitative language, and biologists are responsible for that. But I mean, You know, is this, does this complex exist enough of the time? Say about, if this DNA, we can quantify the amount of time that the binding site here is occupied by the bait, and canonically, by doctrine, we try to get that occupied 100% of the time, basically, okay? So if this is half maximally occupied by the second interacting partner, the prey, then we can for sure see it. We can probably see it down to 10% occupancy, usually. So it just so happens that there's many enzyme-substrate interaction. Oh, and let's see, what else? We throw all this stuff into the nucleus. All the stuff in the cell that we make, we throw into the nucleus. So the concentration of that is between 10 to the minus 6 molar and 10 to the minus 5th molar in the nucleus. So, you know, having said all that, all I'm reduced to saying is enough of the time this complex exists so that we can detect the signal. And empirically, that gets you many enzyme-substrate interactions. Okay, and you know, this, if you go back and look at the on rates and the off rates, the KMs and the KCATs, it makes sense whenever we've done that, okay?
When substrating the protein, what was just said by true for small substrates. But when you get to large substrates, the amplitude could be larger, and there can be a recognition domain that actually binds and waits quite a long time before enzymatic reaction takes place.
Sure.
So it's a slightly different domain of thought, and it can be quite a good thing.
Well, I guess another thing to say is notice that this picture that I just gave you of transcription activation, the whole yeast, this is a whole colony of yeast. Everything is at equilibrium. So we're talking about, you know, the percentage of the time that this red blob is within striking distance of the gene, and if that is more than 5 or 10%. So it's a way of looking at things which it's a cartoon way of looking at things. It ignores the kinetics. But it parallels many biological experimental techniques where basically biologists, particularly geneticists, perturb, and then they, you know, and then a lot of time passes, and they look for the equilibrium outcome of that perturbation. So. Yes. Yes. Yes, that was part of the, in 1985, 16 years ago, when I was making Lexagal-4, I put in a lot of attention to hinges and whatnot. And year by year, I think the person who wins the prize is a guy named Paul Godowski, now director of molecular biology at Genentech. Paul was actually the first person, this was by 1987, to treat proteins as DNA completely. So he said, I'm going to take the Lexa DNA binding domain and I'm going to put BAM linkers on the outside of it. So mixing, in his sentence, protein and DNA, and put that into the HindI3 site in the human glucocorticoid receptor, and it worked. So it is Godowski gets the prize for breaking through the last barrier of propriety and simply ignoring any consideration, even down to the amino acids encoded by the DNA sequences that he was using. He just didn't care, and it usually works.
If the tests don't work, you wouldn't know. Just because you don't see any result doesn't mean that they don't grab.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's, you know, first there's numerous ways to troubleshoot everything, right? You know, we can determine whether these proteins are made, you know, the amounts they're in, whether they're in the nucleus. We can determine whether this protein is capable of binding DNA, and if so, how much. Now, if you don't see an interaction between two proteins, the most common problem empirically is that putting this stuff onto the amino terminus of the fused moiety keeps the amino terminus of the fused moiety from interacting with the prey. And then by doctrine, what do? You put it on the C-terminus. So it's all very, should we break here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Continue.
Okay, now, and that might come in at any point and administrate, so we're warned. Let's see, real-time corrections here. I realized that there's an awful lot of just stuff that's basic how basic about these techniques and so on, which I think would be fruitful to cover here. I can put in what I'm going to propose to do is essentially give the middle of the talk between 2 and 3, which will cover more methodology and stuff like that. And what I'm proposing to do is to attempt right now to lay out the kind of quote physics end quote agendas as I see them, so we can get those on the table. I'm willing to back up during the afternoon, and I will be here Tuesday and Wednesday as well. And I really would like to take the time to do this. So we're going to go through methods. Okay, so we've been through methods, and all right. So, just to again say the obvious. Okay, so insofar as the methods involve physical techniques, experimental physicists are great. Experimental physicists are a lot like good biologists, right? You know, what do you do each day? You know, the vacuum breaks, you call the repair person, you fix the vacuum. You write a few lines of code. You go to the seminar. It's that mixture of things to solve the problem. And these techniques will, at the end, many of them, particularly some of the stuff we need to do, will be based on physical phenomena. So here we go. Now, it's also possible that consideration of any data type may lead to deeper, quote, theoretical, end quote, issues. All right, so now I'm going to lay out some agendas. So this was the last third of the talk. Now look, most biological knowledge right now is qualitative. So if somebody tells you repressor synthesis is induced in a lambda lysogen, if Mark Potashny tells you that tomorrow, he tells you that lambda repressor binds to two sites called OR1 and OR2. When bound to those sites, RNA polymerase has a high affinity and interacts with lambda repressor bound at OR2 to stimulate transcription. So what you have is and that's a simple biological narrative. If you talk to a colleague who works on cell proliferation, they'll tell you this story. The Yiddish word Megillah seems appropriate. It's going to be a story of with lots of proper names of characters that you don't care about or know anything about, and a smaller number of allowed interactions among those actors. So I was struck 2 years ago by the similarity, some similarities between biological information as that's understood, the qualitative information that makes up the biological literature, and geographical information as stored in geographical information systems. Notice biological, here we have proper names. Here we have a small number of permitted verbs, possibly 200 in the realm of things inside the cell. Forms dimers with itself, puts ubiquitin moiety on another, cuts in half, represses transcription. In geographical information systems, you have permitted topological relationships as well as an underlying absolute location, which you do not have in biology. In molecular cell biology, as the narratives go, there's usually a small number of prepositional phrases denoting location. But the point here is that just as this information can be codified in representations that are computable, so can biological information be codified. So I'm going to start with proposing, not just proposing, I mean, you know, trying to get this organized, and there's a couple of other efforts, some commercial, to do this, that the qualitative biological knowledge that we now have be codified in representations that are somehow computable. Here's the wiring diagram again. Now, let's say you have a geographical information system, and you access it via the web to get driving directions. The driving direction application runs on top of it, tells you the route you should take, and if there are obstacles that the GIS knows about, your driving direction app will take that into account and tell you how to get around them. There's at least one other case in which a qualitative computational representation makes it possible to work around obstacles. This really got me excited a couple of years ago. This is part of the plumbing for the Cassini-Saturn mission. Plumbing, I mean hot tubes, and I also mean wires that connect electrically actuated valves. Now, not for Cassini, but for a space probe called Deep Space One, Nicola Muscitola and Brian Ames, Brian now being at MIT, was a professor, made for that spacecraft a representation, a computable representation of its plumbing, which flew the spacecraft for a while. Now, this representation was a so-called QP, or qualitative physics representation. This was stuff launched by some of the AI guys at MIT. Jerry Sussman was involved in the working out. The point here is that Deep Space One, which was controlled by a computable a representation of its plumbing for part of its mission, for the most part, there were no rates. Only for fuel and oxidizer reaching the main thrusters did this representation really care about rates of flow. Rather, for most of the thing, a valve can exist in four states. It can be open, it can be closed, it can be stuck open, or it can be stuck closed. And as the thing gets out there, you know, beyond the asteroid Eros or whatever, sure enough, valves get stuck open and stuck closed. So the task we're posing to this representation is, can I get fuel to this thruster cluster, even though this valve is stuck closed? Or I can't get fuel to this thruster cluster. Can I maintain attitude, given that I can't get this one and I can't get this one? And I better not put fuel to this one, or it'll be stuck open. And, you know. So the point is that this representation did not and needed not incorporate rates to get part of the job done. So this is this was something done. What's the name of the guy? Benjamin Kuipers at University of Texas Austin is another guy on that borderland between AI and physics. So what I'm proposing is, and what we're now trying to line up is representations of qualitative biological knowledge, which go a bit beyond the lists of tables and allowed relationships among them that you see in a relational database, or even object-oriented methods like frame-based methods. These representations know not causality, they know not action, they know not the passage of time. You can embody relationships among things artificially, but there's no built-in verbs, causality, passage of time. Qualitative physics and other AI-type representations may be useful here. So let's say you have them. So what we want to do is represent the biological knowledge, which is largely qualitative, which is derived from experiments like, I make this hyperactive, the cell divides. So what we want is representations which can give the causal consequences of individual perturbations. Just as driving direction things are useful, so might first order systems are able to enumerate the consequences of given perturbations be useful. Those that involve only a few steps of causality from the initial perturbation, and the thought example, which, as time goes by, this is a better and better one. It's 2015. You're an oncologist. You're looking at a printout of somebody's tumor. And it's a list of everything that's wrong with the DNA in the tumor, and all the derangements in protein expression, and it's the state of the amount and the phosphorylation and association state of about 200 key proteins. So you want to know where to intervene. You have a larger pharmacopoeia than you do now. You can intervene at many places. Some of your interventions will be valueless in this particular tumor. Others will be quite valuable. If you were a real human expert, there's possibly nothing that this quote-unquote biological information system could do for you that you wouldn't be able to know anyway. Just like if you were a real expert on how to drive in a given city, there's no set of directions you could get that would help you, even if you knew there was an obstacle in a particular case. But this is, this is a growth area, all right? So I'm going to broach that. We're going to hopefully get back to that during the discussion section. So this is, I'm proposing that that's a real important interim step as we move toward quantitative representations, which is now what I'm going to talk about. Okay, just to if you're talking about reactions among molecules inside cells, then there's different ways to do this. Obviously, you can have giant systems with differential equations. You can have random collision and lookup. Two molecules run into one another. They diffuse into one another. When they do, what's the probability that something happens? Go to a table. And you can have stochastic chemical kinetics. I'll get to that in a second. Note that all three are predictive, but only one is determined, because cells are going to be different. They're going to differ in the number of molecules that are present in small numbers. Now, we primarily lean hard on these stochastic methods. A lot of this is covered in the Nature Review. Yeah, I really should print out two reviews here during the course of this as PDF files and hand them out. So just to, you know, flag this. So let's say you have a reactant decaying to a product. You can solve that, you know, you can think of that as a simple differential equation. And you can solve systems of those numerically. It was the advent, naturally, of the digital computer, which made that possible big time. But over here we have Gillespie, who was a chemist at China Lake Naval Air Station in 1976. And he, you know, this, what I've done is just put a made-up computer language here. What's the probability that a reactant decays to product within a given slice of time? Well, compute that, sample the probability distribution function to determine when the reaction next occurs. Did it occur in this time slice or not? If it did occur, decrement the number of reactants by one and increment the number of products by one and go back to the top. But you can solve systems of these. And so Gillespie worked out how. And he was dissed by his chemist friends. He was dissed, sadly. Oh, Gillespie, they said, solipsistic person, as if we care, as if this is useful. We are chemists. When will we ever be dealing with fewer than 10 to the 17th molecules of what we care about? The continuous flow approximation implicit in calculus is perfectly fine for chemistry. You've helped us not a bit. Now, shift scene, Harvard Biolabs, 1976, 2 o'clock in the morning. So people are sitting around on, you know, shabby couches. Lac repressor represses a lac operon. It's a protein. It's made out of RNA. The lac repressor messenger RNA is transcribed about 8/10 of time per generation in E. coli. Sometimes it's not transcribed at all. Sometimes there's two or three. Lac repressor messenger RNA is translated into protein. Well, probably 10 times, but you see, sometimes it's only twice before an RNA gets it and eats up the RNA. So on the average, maybe 10 molecules per generation. But you see, lac repressor is a tetramer. So maybe it's only 2.5 molecules per. So, you know, we needed Gillespie then. You know, there's considerable cell-to-cell variation. And this is, you know, this is, this was, by the way, first, encountered by the physics immigrant to biology, Max Delbruck, in 1945, who infects bacteriophages. He takes an identical E. coli and an identical bacteriophage, and he infects bacteriophages, and he measures the number of phages that come out. Sure enough, here are 110 phages, here are 92 phages, here are 70 phages, here are 122 phages. And Delbruck says, and publishes, duh, you know, they're not really identical. You know, they're differing in the number of small molecules encoded by these different things. So this must be account for the variation I'm seeing, end of story. It was revisited by Dan Koshland and a coworker whose name I don't remember in 1975 or so with chemotaxis, where there's individual, well-characterized individual cell-to-cell variation among genetically identical things. So we needed Gillespie. We didn't have him. Okay, so now what's going on in the lab? Okay, so here's our target process. This is a signal transduction pathway. This is extremely well understood by the standards of contemporary biology. This is our yeast in its mating frenzy. Okay, it sees pheromone being given off by the yeast of the opposite sex that binds a receptor. The receptor talks to a G protein. The G protein talks to a series of protein kinases. They're assembled on a scaffold. There's various signals coming in here. Two things happen when from this protein kinase. One is it signals the cell, don't divide anymore, don't progress through the cell cycle, freeze up, get ready to mate. And it also turns on transcription of genes. So this is, with the in lambda lysis lysogeny decision, among the two or three best understood phenomena in all of biology. It is the most understood phenomenon in eukaryotic biology. And it's in a system which is budding yeast, which is brewer's yeast, which is tractable and, you know, genetically manipulable, and you can use it as a test tube and ring that changes. So here we are up in Berkeley. Okay, so what are we trying to do? We're trying to figure out how to measure what we need to measure whenever possible from single cells. When we can't devise a means to make measurements from single cells, we're trying to devise means to make measurements from populations of cells. We're trying to develop computational means, and we're learning to better integrate simulation and experiment. Will this need to end at noon, realistically? Yeah. Well, what I'm thinking is maybe I should lay out the physics agendas now and also do this at 2 in the afternoon. So will you let me fast forward through some of what we're actually doing to get to the speculative stuff? Okay. Now, okay, if we had predictive quantitative models, what could we do with them? Now, this is kind of a no-brainer for this audience, but this is a live issue for biologists. So, you know, one thing is, operationally, we're scientists. I think if we had a computational representation that actually predicted, that had within it, you know, had innards that corresponded to what we thought to be true and actually properly predicted future system behavior, we could at some level say we understood it. You know, that might be understanding in the level that if you had a predictive macroeconomic model, you understand the economy. In other words, it might not be true human understanding, but at least maybe predicting the weather, you know. Okay, so, and second, of course, one scientist, you know, predictive simulation of future behavior is another engineer's design tool. In fact, design tool, you know, can also cover evolved designs, most obviously. But for example, the simulator SPICE for electrical circuits allowed, you know, John Koza, Forrest Bennett et al, you know, you can evolve electrical circuits, of course. What they did is they created a language that described circuit genomes, components and connections among them, that you can express a circuit genome as a linear string of characters. You can start with 100 random 10 component circuits, use the existing a generation in the making since the 1970s, simulator electrical circuit SPICE, to simulate the behavior of these circuits and decide which ones are most fit, most correspond to what, most do what you want them to do. You can select four of them that best approximate the desired behavior. You can mate their genomes. You can meiose them, cross over. You can introduce duplications, deletions, point mutations, the whole paraphernalia of biology. Select 100 random progeny circuits, go back to step 3, and keep optimizing. So, you know, they have a company that does this. You know, remember the great days of analog circuit design were probably 1945 or 1950 or so. Human circuit designers are not necessarily as good as they were 50 years ago. So this is an example of stuff that comes out. Now, about these circuits, the typical one is way more complex than one that a human would design. And it's not typically not obvious by inspection, but eventually intelligible to the human who examines it. So that's by analogy, perhaps, to evolved biological systems. And, you know, tantalizingly, the typical circuit, its performance doesn't deteriorate in response to perturbations, so dramatically. So that's tantalizing, isn't it? All right, so in other words, if you had a quantitative model, you could use it to evolve things in silico before you built them. Now, again, obviously, you can find points at which the system is most sensitive to perturbations, and less obviously, you know, if you had a model that you believed, you could test the effects of simultaneous small perturbations on system output. That's something that cannot be done experimentally very easily in biology in general. And it's not it's not how drugs are discovered or drugs are deployed. The pharmaceutical industry identifies a, quote, target, end quote, and then hits that with a hammer. Let's combine two drugs in smaller amounts and various decent things would happen. Right? Okay, so that's just kind of, we can get back to that. I don't think that there was much in that that wasn't obvious here, but now, how can we think about systems? Now I'm going to get really, this is the gutsy part, please don't jump on me. Let's get back to this. Okay, so this is how cells work in the 1950s, and you know, Stoffwechsel, for those who, you know, it's a German word for metabolism. It's a much better word. It means changing stuff into other stuff. You know, and that the industrial economy. Okay. Now the 90s or 00s picture would be decision making, how the source code is read out, how decisions are made, and this is a tradition that launched molecular biology. So, here goes. Okay, maybe this makes historical sense. Genetics was born in a trying to understand how information was transmitted from parents to offspring. That was a lively question. It had not escaped the attention of the gentleman farmers whom Darwin conversed with, you know, or the French encyclopedists, nor Thomas Hunt Morgan. By molecular biology, you know, by the time the structure of DNA was known, by 1955, when I was born, the analogy between the linear sequence of information encoded in DNA and the tape in a Turing machine was well known. Both contemporary molecular biologists and computer scientists were well aware of it. And in fact, the core agenda of post-World War II molecular biology was explicitly about information. How the information is transmitted from generation to generation, that's DNA replication. How the information is read out into messenger RNA and protein, that's transcription and translation. And how expression of the genetic information, the DNA, was controlled. That was repressor molecules. So, in fact, it was in 68, Gunther Stent wrote an article for Science called That Was the Molecular Biology That Was, saying that the core agenda of World War II molecular biology has been solved. The key problems are, we understand how these things work. The rest of you will have to live on the wreckage. Okay, now, actually most of what we know about biology has been learned subsequent to that, but I'm gonna suggest that we revisit that information centrism wasn't wrong. Okay, so now let's think of a cell as a machine that processes three different kinds of information, and this gets back to checkpoints, Terry. One, you know, major flavor of information is the information in the genome, how that's read out. The second kind of information is information coming in from the outside, the mating pheromone that hits the yeast, that if the yeast sees enough mating pheromone, it decides it's going to get ready to mate. The third kind of information, not generally well realized, although you mentioned the magic word checkpoint, but not that much realized inside, is that cells are always sensing their internal state and sending signals within the cell to help them choreograph their internal workings. For example, until my DNA is replicated, I better not start pulling my chromosomes apart. So there's a checkpoint. You know, you arrest, none of the apparatus to pull the chromosomes apart grinds into action until and unless there's a signal that the DNA is replicated. Okay, now, note that, so this is the level inside the cell, and I'm saying, let's think about the information again. Let's get back to the 1950s. Note that beyond the cell level, above the cell level, there's also decision making by groups of cells. For example, those in the nervous system, or which exist in a knowable architecture with respect to one another, and those without knowable architecture. And I'll get back to that at the end. So, you know, historically, the preoccupation of physicists with information processing has been almost entirely to do with the nervous system. There's two reasons for that I can see. One is, what is the appropriate thing that I can study next? The brain, okay? That's reason one, you know. Reason two is the signals are in part electrical, so that they can, be measured and quantified. So I'd say those are basically The two, okay. Now, even when the architecture is under, but let's, I'm not going to say much about the nervous system. Even when the architecture is understood, intracellular information processing is not understood, i.e., you know, this kind of diagram doesn't give you an understanding. It doesn't fulfill you that you think you understand how the process is working. You can't point to where the information is in this system that's being used to make the decision. Okay, now, obviously there's a well-developed theory of information. And it was born in the need to understand transmission, communications through wires and channels. It's had some success, for example, in delimiting the information processing capacity of various things in the nervous system. And, you know, theoretically in distinguishing of the amounts of information that could be encoded in various ways. Okay, let's go back to our intracellular information conveying, processing, and decision-making network. Let's look back. So this scaffold protein, this attracts the attention of these three protein kinases, keeping them in high concentration relative to one another, which accelerates their ability to phosphorylate one another. In fact, you know, instead of the fixed spatial architecture of the nervous system, rather you have this diffusion more or less free within the cytoplasm with kind of floating scaffolds and dry docks being used as needed to kind of assemble a team of components at higher concentration on the fly.
Is this something that you actually have a stochastic model for?
Yes, actually, that was the middle. Yeah, we do.
Okay, so we'll hear about that.
Yeah. So this is basically where at least one main focus of the Molecular Sciences Institute will be for many a year, I think, just right in this very small patch of ground. Okay, so but back to this, these guys on the scaffold. Let's flip the scaffold over. Okay, now blue arrow broadly is where the by blue arrow I mean the flow of information through this system.
One thing, what these are?
These are protein molecules.
No, one more thing.
Okay, this guy's a scaffold. These are protein kinases.
What are they?
They are protein kinases. Their names are sterol 5, sterol 11, fuzz 3.
Are they MAP kinase?
This is a MAP kinase. This is a MAP kinase. This is a MAP kinase.
Okay.
In yeast.
So they perform each other.
Correct. Okay. So these are, you know,
the word kinase
means a thing that phosphorylates.
Phosphorylate another protein.
Correct.
Phosphorylate means adding a phosphate group.
Right. Right, and as this questioner made up, so yeast, this yeast pathway is prototypic for numerous things that occur in higher eukaryotes, and that makes it germane to the affairs of, you know, people who work on people. Let's consider this component. It weighs about 250,000 Daltons. The blue arrows are information through it. Now, canonically, flat-headed arrow means negative regulatory event. Positive arrow means stimulatory event. So these are protein phosphatases, which are known to inhibit the activity of this guy downstream, in the most downstream, the so-called MAP kinase. There's other less well understood but existing negative regulation here. There's probably negative and positive regulation here. Look at this thing. This is part of an apparatus that senses information from outside, transmits it deeper, and helps make the decision whether you divide or not. This is not a wire. It's not an axon. You know, it's processing information, and I can't find anybody in the world who can tell me, from an information processing standpoint, how to think about this. Gets worse. Now, this is from an immunology textbook, and you can't read it. But here we have the immune system, mainly T cell mediated response in response to an antigen. And what you have in the immune system is you have a bunch of cells which are not in a fixed architecture with one another, and it's not even a knowable architecture. You have, quote, high bandwidth, end quote, information processing, information transfer. Cell digests a protein molecule, puts a piece of it on its surface, and shows that to another cell. Look what I've got. And then you have this low bandwidth communication. You have at maximum maybe a couple hundred soluble protein factors. So the whole, and in response to the, instead of a cell switching from state to state, I'm going to attack this guy or I'm going to attack this guy, you have a whole different real design metaphor where you have, I'm capable of recognizing this guy, I'm going to reproduce, I'm going to grow up a clone of myself. In fact, I'm going to throw out variants which are even better. So this whole, how the thing is effected, how the thing is carried out is kind of different from the way a human would design it. How the information is processed in this system is, you know, mysterious. Von Neumann architecture does not help us understanding this. Okay, now it gets even worse. Okay, this is work by a guy named Lucas at UC Davis. This is not widely appreciated right now, but Lucas works on plants. He works on pumpkins and he works on cucumbers. There's a kind of plant that pumpkins are and cucumbers are. I can't remember the name. But the point is, he's always been interested in, if the virus infects the top of the pumpkin, how come is it that the roots of the pumpkin become resistant to the virus? And the answer is that the plant is, you know, acting as a plant to alert itself that it's been infected. So in the phloem, as opposed to the xylem, the phloem is the active transport thing, damned if there isn't a specialized apparatus, kind of like the nuclear pore. And what it does is it is recognizing proteins, and which are either regulatory proteins with tags or particular proteins which bind to the 3' end of any of a host of RNAs, and saying, oh God, you know, this is one of these kind of proteins, pass it up, or this is one of these kind of proteins, let it in. So what you have then is an information processing system in which cells are sluggishly passing, regulatory molecules carrying information are passing sluggishly through the organism. Cells are receiving the information, processing it, acting on it to make new mRNAs and proteins, sometimes exporting those back into the phloem. So it's a kind of, you know, New Orleans to Memphis in 1930 nervous system. It's not fast moving. It is both communicating and processing information, and we don't have a clue, theoretically. Okay, just, you know, it exists, and nobody can help us think about this that I know of. Okay, so that was, what I'm proposing is, I think we could do worse in thinking about the complex systems for a while than to think about them as information processing, because I think there's people who like to think about information processing. There is a body of theory, whether it can map easily or not to this biological realm, I don't know. But, follow the information, think about how the systems are processing the information. Think about either how to adapt the metaphors of information theory, the metaphors of information processing equipment, whether they map, you know, can we map our knowledge to existing theory or backwards? Okay, so now, is there anything for theory here? So I've just described my hopes about information processing. I haven't talked about control theory. I'm trying to learn a lot about this at the moment. My bias is that, again, this isn't going to be an easy transfer at all, that it's built for human-made systems from components whose device physics is understood, and the components are composed into larger systems by human people who tend to think in modules. However, let's not despair. Consider the thinness, intellectual bankruptcy of systems analysis in the 1970s. You know, that was going to be, you know, I don't know if anybody here remembers it, but I'm not a computer scientist, I'm a systems analyst. And the whole idea was that when you bolted the printer to the, you know, CPU, you know, things happened that you hadn't imagined would happen. You know, so there's no, how many people, you know, have used or heard other people use the word emergent property to mean anything they didn't anticipate when the components were assembled? That term has zero explanatory power. Right? I mean, it'd be emergent if after you thought about it, you still didn't understand it. So perhaps, you know, the old issue with the weather, you know, why is it we can't predict the weather? Is it because we don't understand the physics of gases? Is it we don't have computers powerful enough, or is it chaotic? And I cornered a weather person who works at Goddard, a high-dimensional mathematician, 3 weeks ago, and he actually said all three, that we actually don't understand the stuff around ice formation and nucleation. We really don't understand the laws of physics here, you know, enough to predict the weather. Also, we don't have powerful enough computers, and also maybe there's stuff that's chaotic and indeterminate, you know, or at least indeterminate at some level, and obviously there is. But we haven't exhausted the mechanism-based explanation, so, you know, let's expunge that one, you know, or let's not go down roads that don't have any intellectual depth, that don't have any explanatory.
I would argue that the word emergent can be confined to things that happen when you connect a lot of things together that are simple and comprehensible, rather than confusing and unanticipated.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
And that involve large numbers of objects.
Oh.
But that's okay.
Well, then I probably have no quarrel.
I used this word was when I was asked by a journalist, where is the gene for a thumb?
Yep.
So I said there is no gene for a thumb. But there are genes for many proteins that when get together in a particular context,
right,
in embryogenesis, they form a thumb.
Right.
He was very happy about my saying emergent property.
Okay. Yeah, well, it... Okay, well, so it means something colloquially. Back to what you said, I think one of the distinctions we need to make here is that in weather models or in the simple self-organizing system models, you typically have large numbers of things that are identical. Here, like say inside a yeast cell, there might be 3 million proteins, and there might be 3 million individual protein molecules encoded by about 3,000 genes, so 1,000 of each. So you have many more different things, and perhaps fewer numbers. So that probably makes it easier in some ways and harder in other ways, but. Let's also remember that difference, that we have a large but finite number of things that are different from one another here. Okay, so what's to be done? Well, now, let's start small. Has anybody in this room ever heard a description about how a computer program worked that didn't resemble a narrative, where they said the program looks at this and then it decides that? And the more complicated the program, the more it was like a narrative involving animate, sentient actors. I'm trying to say that in the description of how complex computer programs work, we're reduced to the level of narrative, just like biologists are, so that maybe there's a common problem here. Well, let's say that that's where we are. Okay, I'm going to say we can accept theory with a small t. That is, if somebody is explaining to me, I'm going to take any theory I can get. If somebody is explaining to me the politics of early 19th century Europe, like the revolutions of 1814, and they can tell me the stuff that happened, in which case my mind is a blur, or they can begin to tell me about nobility, reaction, the concepts of working classes and bourgeoisie. This will actually help me remember the narrative, make sense of it, give it some overarching thing. I see that the events that happened in the Czech part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire are not too dissimilar from the events that happened in Hungary. So I'm willing to accept theory almost in a political science sense of the word, any kinds of abstractions that allow me one jump up, I'll accept. If I'm talking about dynastic succession in China, and I've mixed up, you know, my dynasties, I can still think of concepts like the mandate of heaven and so on that will help me understand the whole process. I'm going to be content with very little. So here, insights can come from many places, but probably not from biologists who are working too hard. Their minds are too dumb. Okay, now I've said I think there's something, probably something, to do with qualitative knowledge representation, particularly those kinds that transcend relational and object-oriented databases. Now, and just going to throw this out, remember back when people were kind of thinking about information theory, there were kind of two camps. There was kind of Shannon Weiner, and it's like, you know, what's the entropy of this message, right? There was this guy McKay, you know, you remember him? He's the guy who's trying to say, well, couldn't we think about what the message meant? And they go, no, no, you can't understand what a message means. It's unreasonable to think about it. And so, suppose we could measure the changes in brain activity of a recipient, and, you know, from a recipient who had received a complex message with lots of meaning, as opposed to one that didn't. That was enshrined later in the MIT Media Lab, you know, definition of information from the 1980s as a difference that makes a difference. Information theory is as it is because I think correctly people in the late 40s and 50s thought they were unable to come up with any scientific ways to formalize and think about meaning. Okay, now contemporary molecular biology is always telling us about the meaning. Let me get back to your example. So there's a Drosophila protein called Ilis. Now, Ilis is a PAX group protein. It's a DNA binding protein that turns on transcription. You can tell that from the sequence. Ilis also, if you express it in a foot, it makes an eye. So it, in the vernacular, the jargon I was using earlier this morning, it is sufficient in and of itself to fire up a genetic subprogram that leads to making an eye. So in that sense, it causes an eye, and in the other sense, the eye is obviously emergent. You know, but this is just one event which can trigger an eye. So both of these definitions of function for the Drosophila Ilis protein, that it's a PAX group protein, binds DNA and turns on transcription, or that it makes eyes, are true. And biology is just telling us stuff about the proteins that can only be understood in connection with their function. Is there any way, so this is physics, you know, maybe not working with things that are quantitative, but is there any way that we can abstract from and formalize these sorts of knowledge that are true, that people reason with using natural language and go higher? So that's my big shopping agenda here. I don't think that physics or math has the answer, and I know biology doesn't have the answer. I mean, I think there's serious issues here about making abstractions from knowledge. That
how would you go around, suppose the theory is on the table, how would you go around grading the thing?
What do you mean? Well, first, I mean, the best way would be if we had a quantitative model of the yeast alpha factor signal transduction path, and we predicted that if we decrease the concentration of this protein by 12-fold, that this event would occur in 480 seconds when stuck. Right, so that would be great, right? Okay, so, one example would be, you know, let's consider two dismal sciences, economics and meteorology. Okay, now these are things, economics is called the dismal science, meteorology isn't, but let's say that both of these things have the correlate that decision makers are going to seek the advice of economists and meteorologists. They must, and they will make decisions based on the best advice of the economists and the meteorologists, even if it's just not very good. They have to do the best they can. So seemingly, you know, medics are in that relationship with biology as, Alan Greenspan is to, economists, right? They have to make some kind of decision all the time. So I think then our grading criteria would be, did the storm hit? Did the employment increase? Did Mrs. Schwartz die of her tumor? Was it, we could get statistics on that. So that, I guess to end that thread, I mean, from my end, again, I'd be content with very little. If you read an account of, China in the Ming Dynasty, or revolutionary politics in Europe in 1814, you read things and you say, this is insightful. This really helped me understand it. Or you say, your criteria might be quite subjective.
Yeah, but that's what I'm searching for. We have in our mind a good theory in biology to use Mrs. Allen. But how do you grade that answer? No way. Other than sort of by subjective, so more people sort of feel, yeah, it's insightful.
Maybe you're suggesting that if it can inspire experiments, if it's connected enough to the real world to inspire experiments, and those experiments either, can actually test features of the theory and allow improvements in the theory, that would be a good start.
Yeah, absolutely there. Let me flip it around. Let's say we win. I haven't given the middle part of this talk, but let's say we come up with this model of stochastic chemical kinetics, or molecules diffusing in space, that really accounts for and represents inside a computer the yeast response to mating pheromone. And let us say that no human being can comprehend the workings of that model. It's too big. It has too many things in it. So, you could look at the code and you wouldn't be any closer to enlightenment. So, it's possible that we could win in the predictiveness without ever having evolved theory, in the sense of theory being higher level abstractions that give human intellect conceptual traction on things that are that involve myriad, I mean literally myriad, tens of thousands of individual components. So in which case, I don't know how you would grade it, but part of it would be kind of the sensation of intellectual satisfaction. I understand this in terms of these abstractions. So, and how do physicists grade other physicists about that? No, it's not. I think. If it isn't obvious here, we are off the map, and where biology needs to go has driven it off the map from the post-World War II agenda of, find the molecules. Actually, the term molecular biology was coined by a bureaucrat named Warren Weaver, not Shannon's Weaver, I'm pretty sure, but he ran the Rockefeller Foundation. And in 1933, he laid out the agenda. To understand living things, you need to understand the molecules that make up living things. We need to figure out those and how they work. And damn, he was right. But biology is off the map now, at least in this direction of where things need to go, it's off. So I want to hang out here for the next approximately 72 hours and see if any sparks strike. So for those who care, this afternoon I'll do a more methods-oriented thing, the middle of the talk that we skipped. I just wanted to lay out the and be completely vulnerable, therefore, to these.